This is a production from the Yak Podcasting Network. The home for your growing sonic map of local voices, united in their commitment to the best in podcasting.
And welcome back to the Ticket Cities podcast. Spoiler, this is not Jeff Ketchum. Lots of spoilers. You're not going to have Jeff Ketchum today. You're not going to have Jason Sukumel today. Ketchum is going to be a part of the Rivals Publishers Conference today. So he is out. So insert all your jokes about the server crashing on their Zoom conference calls today and just act like it's National Signing Day. So you have that. You have Jason Sukumel. You like that, don't you? Yeah. You have Jason Sukumel, who's probably a pissy drunk on somebody's beach right now because he is on vacation. But you don't have the B team. You still have the A team because you still got Alex with his expert analysis. You still have Dustin. So don't go anywhere because we still got a lot of topics. Dustin, whenever I get a chance to fill in, the one thing I always want to start off in asking is, tell us how the baby boy is doing. I saw the pictures this week. We got some growth and development going. I see what his favorite little pacifier is right now. So give us an update on baby boy.
Yeah, the Texas fans listening will be pleased to know that he's right now selected his Bevo. I guess they're called like Wubba Nub pacifier type thing. So it's like a tiny little plush toy that's like attached to the pacifier, and that's his thing right now. He's in the last like week, maybe 2 weeks, he's been super into like grabbing things. I think it's like he understands now that he can reach out and grab things, and it's so hard when he falls asleep at night and like sometimes he'll wake up and it's just like you have to go put his pacifier back in or whatever. When you go in the room now to put the pacifier in, the moment you put it in his mouth, he grabs your hands and he starts looking at you and it's like, oh no, I can't make eye contact with you, gotta go back to sleep. But it's been so much fun. He's really starting to show more of his personality in the last few weeks. Starting to kind of explore more. A couple weeks ago, I think he realized for the first time that he has feet and that he can touch his feet. And it was just funny to see him, like, we were propping him up. He was sitting there and just touching his feet and, like, wiggling his toes. It's like he was figuring it out for the first time. But, showing a lot more of his personality, really starting to get a little more active with his hands and things like that. And I think he's a baseball fan, too, because – the few times I've had it either on an iPad or the TV, if I'm like carrying him around the room, his head will turn towards the screen and like he's like actively watching it. So I'm hoping that he's picking up on some of the best traits that he's seeing from the game's best pitchers and hitters that he can apply later in life. But no, it's been great. It's been fun, really. I think this is kind of the period where he'll be 4 months next week. You really start to see some of their personality start to come out and they're kind of starting to explore things a little bit more. And thankfully too, it's as you guys know better than I, he's starting to be able to entertain himself a little bit, which I underestimated. You think like, oh, I can work from home and have a newborn. It's like, well, no, you have to entertain them for pretty much every hour they're awake. Until a certain amount of time. So he's starting to kind of, figure out how to entertain himself and play with toys and things like that, which has been good.
So are we at the stage here where we're doing tummy time? Is that around now, Dustin?
Yeah. Yeah. He's been doing that for a little while. Hopefully we're getting to the point where it's like his neck and his head are getting strong enough to where he's able to just be stable and support himself that way. I guess this is around the age and maybe a little bit after that they kind of are able to get into those like those jumper toy things where they can kind of start jumping around because they can hold their head steady. So yeah, definitely been a lot of tummy time. Definitely been the first rollovers have been happening while he's doing tummy time. It's sometimes we'll put him down there now to just kind of hold his head up on his forearms or whatever. And he'll just immediately roll over because he thinks it's funny. So that's the next phase would be in bed rolling over, which we're kind of terrified for because it's like the first time you look on a monitor and see that your kid's face down, you're probably going to freak out because it's like, oh, no. Yeah. But they all say like when they're able to do that, they they understand, like, you know, how to breathe and all that sort of thing. And that's not a big issue.
Alex, this talk of babies, does it make you want to go ahead and fire it up again? You want to do it one more time?
No, I still have babies, man. I still say, like, what's going on with my babies? That, like, yeah, I have a 2-year-old. So, like, I'm just now basically to where I think I am at the spot where I think I crossed my fingers. I might have changed my last diaper. My son during this whole time is finally taken to potty training, and he's doing a really good job. He's really proud of himself about it. And so no real accidents. It's been good to have mom and dad, you know, home with him, and really, you know, because my wife, of course, is an educator. So they're kind of online right now. So she's working, but she's around them, and she can see when he's when he needs to go get his ass put on the potty. So having her around instead of just being daddy daycare has helped a whole ton with his potty training. So absolutely not, man. There's no more little Dunlaps in the clan here. Once you get that you feel like you turn the corner on changing diapers, it's a pretty big deal. You don't want to go back to it. You really don't.
No. I trust me, as a kid who had turned that, the guy had turned that corner and then had the oops baby, I was like, oh, so here I am right now. So I'm with you. Like, my kid's 2. He's starting to get on the potty right now. And I'm just like, you know, but you know, you guys know one of our former sponsors gave me a vasectomy. So I made sure that would never happen. But yes, Dustin, I'm with you. But you know, Dustin, enough, this is number one. So they're going to hit that point where they get to that 3-ish or so, 4-ish stage, and they're going to forget about all this little stuff that they're going to see it in pictures and romanticize it. And then they're going to do it one more time. So, so we know what's going to happen. But enjoy it, Dustin. All right. So we do have some news. And Dustin, I do want to start off with you, Mr. Mom over here. So Dustin, check this out. This has been a running list that I have kept this entire offseason. All right, are you ready? Juwan Mitchell doesn't stand for the eyes of Texas towards the end of the season, decides to go into the transfer portal, comes out a couple of weeks later, says he doesn't want to play for the University of Texas, but never misses a practice. He's still part of the program. Denzel Okafor goes into the transfer portal, comes out like a week or two later, still a part of the program. Brennan Eagles voices his displeasure about UT, eyes of Texas, blah, blah, blah. He's at the Zoom meeting the very next day. DeMarvion Overshone says he's not playing, and then he shows up for practice. And then we had Anthony Cook, who shows up late. He's here for maybe a week and change, and then decides he's going to the transfer portal. He's leaving. That's back in June. And now Anthony Cook is coming back. So first and foremost, are we to pay attention? Should we be paying attention to anything these guys are saying or doing, transfer portals, not transfer portals? Because I feel like these guys have said a whole lot in this offseason, and it really hasn't amounted to much.
Yeah, I was joking with somebody yesterday when I was texting around about Anthony Cook's portal status, and I go, Texas has to leave the country, has to lead the country in round trips to the portal. Like, they go in and they come back out. Like, it's like a round trip ticket for some of these guys in the portal, which is, I think, very uncommon. If you look across the country, like, it's pretty uncommon for guys to enter the portal and then come back out. Like, unfortunately, we have to pay attention to all that stuff because our members on our message board, our very active message board, when it comes to those sorts of things, definitely pay attention to it. But I think we need to, include a disclaimer and maybe just borrow a coronavirus disclaimer for sports in general right now, is like, just subject to change. You know, yes. Maybe that's how we label everything, because we have to pay attention to it. But it's like, okay, guys, like, just keep in mind that there's the possibility, maybe even the distinct possibility, that this decision doesn't hold and it changes and these guys are back in the program. So you got some young men that are going through some things and expressing themselves in certain ways. But, it's pretty wild that so many of these guys have either entered the portal or tweeted something about not being with the program, and then are in the mix with the program soon after that. I don't know if that speaks like well of Texas. Like, they just created this environment these guys just want to be a part of, even when they say they don't want to be a part of it. But yeah, I think we need to label everything as kind of a subject to change whenever those types of topics come out.
It does seem subject to change. And the Anthony Cook situation is a really unique situation, clearly, for all the things that are involved. Now, of course, in the ideal world, what we love to say is, all right, OB, do not overreact to this thing. But then it wouldn't be orange bloods, and because that means people would have rational reactions. And that just is not what we do at all. So, okay, so overall, what do you make of that whole Anthony Cook thing? Like, just Anthony Cook specifically, for a person that you've seen as a recruit here, as a player, was here, not here, just him specifically, speak on what you think about where he's at and him coming back to UT. You're good with it? You're happy with it? Just give me your overall thoughts.
Yeah, I think he's a young man that was going through some stuff, and maybe trying to figure some things out. I don't think it's a bad thing that he's back at Texas. I think that's probably when he thought about it and talked to people closest to him and, considered, his steps moving forward, that was the best environment for him. I mean, this is a guy that, thinking back to that 2018 recruiting class, so many of those Houston guys were part of that class, and so many of them really knew each other well. And a few of them were high school teammates. You think of Lamar High School and how many guys came out of that group. So I think that this is probably when he thought about it, probably understood that, okay, like, this is the best environment for me. This is the best support system for me. It's relatively close to home. This is probably where I need to be. And perhaps he just needed some sort of unique way to come to that realization, or just needed some time off to kind of handle his own things. But I don't think it's a bad thing. I think this is a guy that, had some flashes on the field last year. I think he's a guy that seems like people like. I mean, when the news first came out about him, you saw some Texas players kind of, tweeting or reacting like, hey, don't worry, we're gonna, he's gonna be back, or we're gonna try to keep him in the mix, or so on and so forth. So I don't think it's a bad thing. I think that it's, it's probably a good thing that he's back, and because I think he would understand that, okay, this is a support system I need. This is the place I need to be to try to achieve my goals and become the best person I can be.
Is the transfer portal, Dustin, when is it become this mythical thing amongst players that believe that, I'm not happy, and I'm going to go in this transfer portal and I'm going to go to Georgia or Alabama or something like that? Because at the end of the day, what I normally see, Dustin, is especially for kids who have left Texas, I don't see guys trading up. I see the majority of guys going into the transfer portal, and when they come out, the majority of them are going to smaller programs. It doesn't seem like the majority of them. I think there's maybe been one guy that, and I forget his name right now, but went into the transfer portal and he ended up getting drafted. I think it was like the third round last year. You give me a second.
Jordan Elliott?
Yeah, Jordan Elliott. And I think he might be the only guy that we look at and say, okay, that guy for sure, it worked out for him. Majority of guys, though, Dustin, I mean, they seem to end up at smaller programs. And, do you think there's going to be a time where people realize, hey, your draft stock was probably highest when you were a junior or senior in high school, but when you're at a program and you're there for 2 years or more and you don't play, no one's really going to be as high on you about when they realize, like, the main reason you're leaving is because you're just not good enough to start at where you're at.
Yeah, I think you're seeing more across college football. I think that guys are maybe realizing the grass isn't always greener on the other side. And Jordan Elliott, I think, is going to end up being one of the few exceptions to the rule. It's kind of not a truly defined rule, but there's kind of like if you see a guy that's committed to multiple schools, that's kind of a red flag. And then you see a guy committed to multiple schools during his career, and then he transfers. You just don't often see those guys pan out. Even the highly rated guys. So, Yeah, I can't really think. You know, there's obviously been the high profile situations of guys that are really good players that have transferred. You know, your Justin Fields of the world and things like that. But so often you're seeing these guys that are, you know, if it works for them, they were clearly good enough to play where they were, and they did play. They just left for whatever reason. Or you're seeing a lot of those graduate transfers who have proven themselves already, but are just going somewhere to have a locked in for sure opportunity. But yeah, I think maybe you're seeing that some of these guys that, like, you know, these guys fancy themselves as really, really good players, really talented players. They remember the recruiting process when all these top programs wanted them. And then maybe you enter the transfer portal and it's not quite what you think it is. And then the idea of leaving your situation that you're in isn't as appealing anymore. But yeah, I can't really think of many situations that weren't graduate transfers where you see a lot of these situations pan out for these guys to where they just become better players. They realize all their full potential. They're extremely productive, and then they go on to the NFL and reach those heights that they want to reach. It just doesn't happen that often. It's just, you know, usually when guys are transferring, there's a reason, and often that reason focuses on playing time. And if you're not playing somewhere, you know, what makes you think that you're going to go to another high profile program and get that immediate playing time?
Alex, let's go to you because you are our depth chart guru. Okay,
can I also say just something on top of that? I think that, you know, there was obviously across the world and across the country this spring and summer rampant unhappiness with all sorts of situations people found themselves in, right? You got different quarantines and different stuff you're having to do. You can't be around your friends the same way.
It was an environment that could make people crazy, and I can't fault anybody for feeling that way.
You sit around. It's even still to this day, you turn on the news, you got Fauci telling us we might have to start wearing goggles, and there's a million things. It can drive you nuts. And I think that these kids, they're young kids, as Omar was saying, sometimes you see that portal as this mystical portal that could whisk you away from whatever issues that you have. And maybe this season, I mean, these are 18, 19 year old guys. They go into the portal and they realize, well, you know, now that I'm talking with these new coaches, it's like, it isn't like everything's going to magically change back to how it was, you know, before just because I'm changing schools, you know, and that could be a realization that some of these guys could come to too. I think that this spring and summer has exacerbated, I guess what I'm trying to say, it's a long way of saying, I think this spring and summer have exacerbated that mysticism of being able to whisk yourself away that could be associated with the transfer portal.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, you compound that with the state of the world where we're at, where if you're a coach, you're wanting to isolate your players and keep your team together. You know, are you bringing in someone else? You know, and yeah, you can go through, you know, protocols and all those other type of things, but you might just want to keep your core together. And to your point though, Alex, you know, one of the things I've heard is that, hey, you know, when you've had a bunch of kids who have been isolated, who are not being able to participate in sports, that have been doing it for 8 years, 10 years, like this has been their life, you know, for the most of their life, and all of a sudden they're stuck at home, they're in mom's house for months and weeks and weeks, and that'll get to you once you finally get out the house, you know, you had to have to go back and live with mom. There's some stresses, and then now all of a sudden all you have right now is you don't have your friends, you don't have practice. All you have is, you know, some workouts in television, and you can't go to certain places. You got to remember back in a lot of when this happened, you couldn't go out to restaurants, you couldn't go out to clubs. And so it has taken the psychological damage on, at least affected certain kids. And then maybe some of them realize, you know what, I just needed to calm down and get back here. So Alex, from a depth chart perspective, I'm curious, because I'm sure you had to remove Anthony from your depth chart. Where was he on your depth chart? And just so for background, one of the things I reported yesterday is he's going to have to start from the bottom of that depth chart. Like, they're not going to let him come back, and just his jersey number is already gone. It's already been handed out to somebody. So, I mean, that's one of the things communicated with him.
Oh, man, that's cold.
Yeah, well.
Hey, well.
I mean, there's nothing wrong with making that move, but, like, man, like, those single-digit jersey numbers are so coveted. That's going to be a bummer. But that's the repercussions of what you did.
Correct. Your jersey number's gone. You're going to be on the bottom of the depth chart. We're working to get your scholarship back. You'll get it at some point, but we're working. I could fill out the paperwork to get your scholarship. But if you're willing to come from the bottom and start your way back up, you're more than willing to be a part of the program again. To which he said, okay, I will be a part of the program again. I want to come back. So where do you think, you know, clearly he starts from the bottom. Where was he at before? And just give us your analysis as to how far or long you think it might take for him to get back to where he once was.
Well, it was interesting coming into the spring because we had the reports that he'd be moving to compete at the nickel position as opposed to the outside corner, which he had played during his entire time thus far at Texas. That was looking like it was going to be a pretty clear-cut battle. You know, one of the more clear-cut battles as we came into spring was going to be Chris Adamora, the sophomore, and Anthony Cook, the junior. And after the Anthony Cook stuff happened, we sort of had to just kind of go back and take a look and say, well, let's just look at the guys that played in sub package roles last year. Maybe there's some, clearly we knew that there was some crossover between some of the guys competing at outside corner and some of the players who could maybe fill in at the nickel and even at the safety position. Because when you look at it, Chris Brown, who at this point, based on what some of Onwar's sources have said, would probably slot in as the starter opposite Caden Stearns at safety if the season were to start today. I just wonder if the season were to start today caveat had anything to do with the fact that BJ Foster hit the back of a car because his car got hit, so he decided to hit his bumper and
allegedly which by the way you would have to be punching down to hit your bumper. So there's some like metrics. I'm trying to figure out how that physics, that's the word I'm looking for. There's some physics to that. I'm trying to figure out. Did he get on his knees and punch that? Like, how did that work? But
we'll do some mental gymnastics. Yeah. So you don't know if the reason why Chris Brown would be the starter, if this season started today, if that had to do with the fact that BJ Foster would not be cleared if the season started today at the time we were told that. With that being said, it feels like BJ Foster and Chris Brown have a bit of a competition going on at a safety that Chris Brown's going to have to attend to. But Chris Brown did play 37.64% of his snaps last season in the nickel role. And if you look at it in total between the nickel role and that third safety slash joker position, and then also that dime safety cowboy slot, he actually played a total of 68% of his snaps last year in sub packages. So he was definitely a sub package player. Chris Adamora, 110 snaps in the nickel. That was 96% of his total snaps on the entire season. But Chris Adamora, only 110 snaps on the season whenever you include the bowl game. Josh Thompson had 99 snaps last season and played 75% of those snaps at the nickel. So while Josh Thompson might be competing I had him slated to be competing with Deshaun Jameson for an outside corner role. With what we've seen from the state-sanctioned media that's allowed to us by the Texas Sports Information Department, there sure is a lot of edits being made by the media staff for Deshaun Jameson, a lot of stuff calling him the shark, a lot of stuff highlighting the way he moves and stuff in practice. I'm beginning to think that it's pretty locked in with Jalen Green and Deshaun Jameson here at these safeties. I'm not sure that that's going to be something where Josh Thompson fits in. And so I had originally thought, okay, if we're looking at Chris Adamora as maybe the odds-on favorite here to start at that nickel slash spur role, I think that the competition is going to have to come from somewhere in the absence of a Anthony Cook. And Josh Thompson was probably the guy who, like I said, played 75% of his snaps last year in the nickel. He's already been talked about by the new defensive coordinator as a standout that he noticed on tape, et cetera, et cetera. It really only began to kind of make sense, and maybe an outside shot of Chris Brown fitting into work over there in case BJ Foster did take back over that safety role with authority opposite Caden Stearns. Now it feels like with Chris Brown having his own, like he has his own chickens to tend to over at safety, I think Chris Adamora maybe to some degree, Josh Thompson, if it looks like DeSean Jameson is locking down that corner, and Anthony Cook, like Armour said, man, he's going to be bottom of the totem pole trying to work his way up. And it wasn't like he was coming from a position of any sort of great strength. Anthony Cook, despite the fact that he was an excellent prospect coming in, he was thought of maybe as – I mean, Dustin will remember. I mean, was he thought of more highly than Jalen Green?
He was a five-star at one point, and then ended up being downgraded at the end. But, yeah, certainly at one point, absolutely.
He was a 48% snap participant last season. Some of the games where he played the most were some of Texas's worst. Like, you know, he played his greatest amount of snaps in that Kansas game, which was just a debacle and an embarrassment. And if you just look at him versus Chris Adamora last year, so snaps per production caused, Anthony Cook was 18.24, which was 22nd place out of 26 qualifiers. Chris Adamora was 7.13 snaps per production cost, which was third place of 26 qualifiers. We should also think about the fact that, you know, Anthony Cook hasn't played a snap at nickel during his time at Texas. That's all Chris Adamora played last year. So not only is he going to have to figure it out, but he's going to be behind the eight ball as far as the rest of this stuff. Also, he was in position as an outside corner to defense more snaps, because in an outside corner, you typically get targeted more than these nickel corners do. His snaps for pass defense last year, which included a pass, like a pass breakup, a blow up, or an interception, Anthony Cook went 82.2 snaps per said event, right? He went 82.2 snaps for every play where he created a pass breakup, a blow up, which is a blow up is just a pass breakup where you blow the shit out of the guy and you knock him down too. And then an interception, right? Once every 82.2 snaps. For Chris Adamora, it was once every 24 snaps. So Chris Adamora is getting this done, you know, 3.5 times more often, you know, defending his passes on a per snap basis. The completion percentage allowed when they were clearly targeted last year, Anthony Cook allowed a completion percentage of 63% when he was clearly targeted. Chris Adamora would allow a 40% completion percentage when he was clearly targeted. So a difference there between 63% for Cook, 40% for Adamora. The snaps per coverage burn last year, Anthony Cook was burned once every 137 snaps, whereas Chris Adamora just wasn't burned on the season period. So he's not even a qualifier for that. And then the only way that Anthony Cook showed out any better than Chris Adamora via any of the metrics that I monitor would be on the snaps per missed tackle. And it was basically even. Anthony Cook went 68 snaps per missed tackle, whereas Chris Adamora went 72. So if Anthony Cook weren't such a high-end prospect coming in, you'd probably say there's not even a contest here. It should probably be Chris Adamora. When you throw in the fact that Josh Thompson is likely going to be over there, I'm not sure how much Anthony Cook is going to play this season.
You know, as you talk about DBs and stuff like that, and you have all your metrics out there and just – you know, moving away from that spur position for a second, though. I'm curious, Alex, your observations, because you mentioned a lot of different guys. You talked about Adamora, you talked about Green, you talked about Thompson, and you don't really mention Kenyatta Watson, and I get it because he didn't play a lot, but it seemed like the one game that Kenyatta got to play in at the end of the season seemed like a baller. I'm curious to what those numbers look like, you know, for that one game right before the bowl game, and your overall assessments of Kenyatta, because it's a one game sample size, right? So it's not a ton, but it seemed to me that maybe Kenyatta is a guy that maybe deserves a little bit more run, because I end up looking at the end of the season and said, well, why hadn't that guy played a little bit more?
So it was the Texas Tech game where he played 66.25% of the snaps in that one. And if you look at what he was able to do in that game, he had the one really big pass breakup. He was thrown at four times and only allowed one. So he was only allowing a 25% completion percentage in that game. And also he was a really effective tackler there in that game as well. I'd like to look back and just see what his overall snaps per production caused was, because he clearly didn't play enough to where he only played 72 snaps on the whole entire season. He was generating production. He generated production at a greater clip than any other cornerback on the team. That's a good observation on a per-snap basis. He was at 11.52 snaps per production caused, just in front of DeSean Jameson, who would be second place among corners at 11.76 snaps per production caused. So a little bit better there. And like we mentioned earlier, the 25% completions allowed there versus Texas Tech, certainly, you know, when comparing that to everybody else on the season, I mean, you look at, say,
Texas Tech had a good quarterback. I mean, they had a decent quarterback that was playing.
DeSean Jameson on the season was like a, you know, he allowed like 49%. Let's see what Anthony Cook, like we talked about, 63%. Jalen Green was a 53% completion percentage when clearly targeted. So, that's interesting. But Kenyatta Watson's an outside corner, and I just don't see him overtaking Jalen Green or DeSean Jameson. I mean, is that something that you've been hearing about?
No, I haven't. I have not. It just was one of those things that when I watched the game and rewatched it, and it was just like you just kept seeing them. Again, I don't keep the metrics, so all I can go off of is the eye test, right, of what I'm seeing. I haven't heard it, but then I just kept wondering. It was one of those, like, why hasn't this guy played more? I mean, it seems obvious that this guy can have an impact, and I've just been wondering about it. And then, you know, I haven't mentioned him all season to knock myself. I probably should have asked about him, and maybe I should ask about him a little bit more today. So maybe I've just given myself something to write about or at least look into. But it just seemed like Kenyatta Watson is a guy that it's weird that – Alex that and Dustin remember this, that they bragged about Kenyatta Watson and him, you know, having a dad who was a coach and him being smart. I think it was Herman when Kenyatta first got here that praised that. I think he said he's something to the effect that he was like one of the smartest players that they had, or at least one of the smartest freshmen that they had. There was some sort of praise for how smart he was as far as a football player. So I don't have it specific, but something like that. So I've always thought, oh, okay, well, Kenyatta, it's just a matter of time, and I just hadn't seen it. Then when I finally saw it, just a question that I had. That's all.
Yeah, and I think that it's a good question, because if something were to happen to Jalen Green or DeSean Jameson this year, depending on how things work out with Josh Thompson, maybe he'd be the first man up. But, you know, Kenyatta Watson's only a redshirt freshman. He's only going to be a redshirt, like mm-hmm. – Or so, I guess. What was he? Was he? I guess he got to play last year, but he's still did he still redshirt? Because I've listed as a redshirt. I guess he played in less than four games. Let me actually just look back and make sure that that's correct, if you don't mind. So,
Okay, dead air is good.
Defensive player participation. Kenyatta Watson.
Yeah, he redshirted. I think he got in.
He played in the Tech game. He played on defense in the Iowa State game. He played on defense in the West Virginia game, and he played on defense in the Louisiana Tech game. He only played in
four. Yeah, he redshirted.
So, all right. Yeah. No, I mean, he's only a redshirt freshman. So even if these guys, you know, rock it out for the next 2 years, that would mean by the time he's, what, a junior? He'd be in terrific position to start. But we all know that things don't move in a linear fashion like that, and things can happen really fast in college football. And having a guy like Kenyatta Watson there, you're right. Well, I mean, we haven't talked much about him this off season, but I am reminded of that game and the fact that, I mean, among Texas outside corners on a small sample size, he was the most efficient on a per snap basis. So that's something excellent to kind of keep in your back pocket. And yeah, I'd be interested in hearing any updates from the staff on how that guy's looking and everything as well.
One more kind of football specific thing, on topic, off topic, before we switch to something else. One thing I've reported in the war room last week, Alex, and I kind of want to get your take on this, was about DeMarvion Overshown, because the one thing that they wanted to do with him is to increase some weight within the off season. And when he finally shows up, just recently, he showed up at, you know, just so you, for point of reference, he weighed 214 pounds in February. The staff wanted him originally around 225. So he shows up and he weighs 221, which everyone views as a plus. And so what they're thinking about trying to do is, like, if he's at 221, maybe they could get him to about 230 pounds to start the season, and at least, you know, that's the goal, to see if they can add in, so yes, as a guy who works out, who understands this whole type of thing, okay, him showing up at 221, do you want him at, is 225 probably a more realistic weight goal, and do you think he could probably operate better, or should they go for it all and try to get him at 230?
Dude, if he came back from ARP, Texas, away from the football team this whole damn time, weighing 221 on his own, imagine what they could have done with him, having him here for the offseason with the team.
Yeah.
I think it's fine to adjust those expectations. If I were the staff, I would have expected him to come back maybe weighing 3 or 4 pounds more, not you know, whatever, seven pounds more. So I think that the calculus there is fine. I think shooting for some, you know, shoot for 230. If you get somewhere above 225, it's fine. You know, having a overhang sort of linebacker like he's slated to be in Chris Ash's defense, weighing 225, when he could bring the thump the way that DeMarvion Overshown can, and also the fact that DeMarvion Overshown is long and lanky and still even a little bit gangly. You generally don't see a guy that's a little bit gangly being such an enforcer like that. The weight that they're going to be adding on is going to be extremely good weight. By the time he's done at Texas, man, that could, you know, he could be one of these 235, kind of 240 undersized linebackers as he really grows into his full grown man body. And I think, you know, for right now, being on his way there, I think that shooting for 230 is fine. I think if you end up getting to 230, that'll have him well on his way to, after his junior season, maybe coming to his senior season, getting up to that 235, sort of 240-ish window. And whenever you look at the guys that have come in like that, I'm trying to remember what, like, Deion Jones weighed whenever he was coming out. But guys, you know, Deion Jones only now weighs 220 pounds. And he's one of the, you know, one of the really good, versatile kind of tight end covering, receiver out of the backfield covering linebackers in the league there for the Atlanta Falcons, on a defense that really prides itself on the ability to bend but don't break. And the way that they can do it is they can just absolutely hemorrhage underneath receptions to opposing running backs. Ask Christian McCaffrey, to opposing tight ends. Ask any tight end in the NFC South. But the reason they can do that is because you have a guy like Deion Jones who's so fast sideline to sideline that at 220, he can be such an enforcer that he can just clean that garbage up for you underneath. And you're going to dare a team to kill you by 1,000 cuts whenever you have that kind of player. So I don't necessarily think he's got to get up to, you know, 230 or 240 to be any kind of guy that the NFL is going to be super interested in. I think that they could probably do it, considering he came in at 221 working out in what, like, in the, I'm sure, the world-class facilities that they have up there in ARP, Texas.
yeah, that might have been the equivalent of what is it, Cork Jacquez making that Home Depot, putting cements in a bucket and going there. I Googled ARP, Texas, and it reminded me of some of those small towns in Florida. And so what, for him to come back like that definitely shows that there was some dedication to the cause and to everything else. So Dustin, let me go back to you. So, you know, we one of the questions that Ketch has asked over several podcasts, and he always kind of checks in and says, okay, what do we think the percentages of a football season being played would be? And I think for the majority of us, we've probably been over 50% lately. There's some things that happened this week that I think has got us, you know, got to have us in the 80s or 90s. We've seen a couple of things. We've seen the ACC come out this week, the ACC and the SEC specifically, but the ACC decided that they're going to do an 11-game schedule, right? So 10 conference games with one non-conference game, and they're going to start somewhere between September 7th through the 12th. The SEC has not – and by the way, with the ACC, that's part of – they've added Notre Dame into that fold, so Notre Dame gets a chance to compete for an ACC title. Who knows if that ends up being a good marriage, but for at least for right now, that'll happen. SEC, we're hearing reports that they're going to go conference only, so probably just a 10-game kind of season for them. Then it's the Big 12 that's leading from the rear because they've decided to do – they haven't done anything. We haven't heard anything. Dustin, I'm sure you have some optimism about football being played at some point in September, whether it's the early portion of September or was the later part of September. But what do you think, if we're a guessing man, and this is a guess, so no one hold him to it. What are you guessing that maybe the Big 12 should do in this instance? Because everybody else has kind of made a decision, or at least we've hearing reports of them, and we just got to wake up Bowlesby and say, hey, dude, you're on the clock.
Yeah, the Big 12 has decided to consider options. That's the only thing that they've really decided during all of this. And I think at this point, yeah, there's definitely optimism growing that there's going to be a season. And, you know, considering the way this week started with the news of what was going on with the Miami Marlins, I think that there was some probably some panic throughout college football, like, oh, no, like is this thing about to grip Major League Baseball and pause its season? And, you know, as the days have gone on, like pretty much everything during this pandemic, things can really change after a day or 2 days or 3 days. But it seems like that is a singular issue with that organization. There's been some reports out that some of those guys just weren't conducting themselves in the right way off the field. So I think the optimism around college football is growing, and I think that's there's evidence in that and what the ACC is doing and kind of what's coming out about the SEC. And obviously, we know what the Big Ten's plans are. And I don't think the Big 12 is going to have much of a choice now but to go with this kind of hybrid conference-only type of schedule and then just maybe have a plus-one opportunity or perhaps even a – you know, a plus two opportunity for some non-conference games down the road later in the calendar. So I think that that's probably what's going to happen is a conference only schedule and then a plus one, or if they feel they need to add another game, maybe a plus two later on. And they'll probably try to, with these non-conference games, figure out a way to make sure that they're not very, very early in the season to where you're not like kind of similar to what the ACC did. But although you've got schools like Oklahoma and Kansas that are trying to move some things up, but I just don't see now that if the SEC is not going to play a full 12 game schedule with non-conference opponents, and the ACC is kind of, just doing the one non-conference thing as well, or just really focusing on a conference only schedule. I don't think the Big 12 has a choice, but to come up with its own method to basically just focus everything on a conference-only schedule and see if you can squeeze in a non-conference game in addition to that. But I think the really good thing is, you know, like you said, there certainly seemed to be optimism growing that a season is going to happen because they've gone through all this planning and they've clearly – we know this time period, late July, was supposed to be when all these conferences and these decision-makers were supposed to decide on these things. You had Texas come out earlier this week and say they're focusing on they've requested that they focus on 25% capacity. So it seems like some decisions are trying to be made, which I think is a good thing about the future of the football season, at least kind of happening on time.
Alex, if you were ruler of the Big 12, what would you want? Would you want a 9-game conference only schedule, or would you try to do 9 plus 1 and add in a non-conference game? Or I would not say add in, but keep a non-conference game.
I think that you guys are saying that you think that the Big 12 is leading from behind here. And look, I'm not going to give the Big 12 or Bob Bowlesby credit for anything, right? I'm not going to give him credit for doing this for the right reasons. But the fact is, you know, there are some – I think sometimes they're like – there are some things that my late great dad used to tell me and just would pound into my – I just off the top of my head, it's like, you know, stuff that everybody's parents have things they always tell, you know, like it's never okay to hit a woman, or, you know, vote for policies, not politicians, or – just trying to think, like, you know, if you're always working and you love your job, then you're never really working. And one of the other important things you always tell me is that you always want to have the most information before you make a decision. You want to be the guy with the most information whenever you make your decision. And so at a time like this, where people are in complete information gathering mode, it's just been in my DNA to always say, I'm going to sit back here. I'm going to keep my mouth shut. I'm going to buy my time. I'm going to see what other people are doing, because I want all the information to come out. I'm not necessarily the one who wants to be the first mover here, who wants to be the beta tester. I'm usually a fan of a wait and see approach. So now whether or not it's up to you know, each person to figure out, well, as you're taking this wait and see approach, are you leaving yourself in a place of weakness? Right? Like, are you putting yourself in a spot where other, the first movers are going to put you in a spot to where they're dictating what you have to do. And at that point, you have to weigh, you have to weigh the two things against one another. How much is this extra time? How much is this extra information? What sort of value am I extracting from it? When the obvious penalty for taking that line of an approach is, okay, if this conference goes to conference only, this conference goes to conference only, at that point, my hands are tied. There's nothing else I can do because I can't schedule an out-of-conference game, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So to me, it's a balancing act of those things. And if I'm the Big 12, I mean, let's be honest. People aren't waiting every day to hear the Big 12's announcement. People are waiting to hear the SEC's announcement. You know, I'm torn. You know, I don't necessarily think they're doing a bad job, but then again, I don't want to leave an opportunity on the table not to criticize the Big 12 and their leadership. I think the Big 12 is trash. I don't necessarily think it's the worst call. I think that there's always at least some virtue in waiting, seeing, and being the one that can gather the most information.
So it now that they've got all the cards are in front of them, right? And for the most part, I mean, SEC is not finalized, but you know, we're hearing reports and no one's making that up, right? So unless something happens and the SEC says, okay, let's add in another one and keep a non-conference game. Let's say everything's in front of you, right? So you know the Pac-12 is pushing things back. They're only going to do non-conference. We know the Big Ten is – I keep saying non-conference. They're going to do conference only. I apologize for that. Big Ten, conference only. SEC, more than likely, conference only. We've got the ACC, what they look like. What do you think the Big 12 should do?
Well, I think they should play if everybody else is going conference only, they should go conference only. If some of these other conference schedules are 10 games, I would find a way to add an extra game from one of the unaffiliated teams, because that way, you know, how are they going to do a playoff or bowl games or anything like that? How is a national champion going to be crowned? Like, is it necessarily fair to go into some sort of, you know, if there was some sort of, I don't even know, man. Like, doesn't everybody need to play the same amount of games? At least the ones who are going to be in it till the end to presumably move on to some sort of bowl system or some sort of rankings system. How do you square up this conference only played 9 games versus this conference played 10 or maybe 11? Or I think I would want answers to those questions, and then act accordingly.
I'm holding out hope that they expand the playoffs just for a one-time thing. Because, yeah, like you said, Alex, how are you supposed to crown somebody if there's not a really consistency across the board in amount of, you know, games played or, you know, conference games versus non-conference games?
And then how do you measure the strength of a conference in any given year if they haven't played against any other conferences?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm holding out hope that because so many people are going to need more money out of this, there's an easy way to gain more money, just expand the playoffs, because that'll bring in an insane amount more of television dollars, and especially for a collective American fan base that's so starved for sports. Can you imagine giving them an 8-team college football playoff or like a eight team system to where, you know, maybe you expand it more and you give 8 teams a bye or something like that. This is an opportunity for them to get really creative
and make some money back.
Absolutely. And you wouldn't have to necessarily worry about the, you know, oh, we're asking a team to play like 15 games like normally would happen. No, it's, you know, most of these teams are only going to play 10, 11 games. So they wouldn't have any issue playing 2 or 3 more games. So that's what I'm holding out hope for, because there's going to be a lot of important people that are in charge of these athletic departments that need more money. And that's definitely a way to get it.
Definitely. Now, of course, you just would need everyone to come together, and
I don't like to think about that element of the equation, but yeah, you'd have to have a lot of people that aren't on the same page to get on the same page. But if there's one thing that can bring them all together quickly, it's money.
Okay, so let me ask you guys these questions. I mean, we may have covered this last week. I know my answer, but I want to get yours. So let's in a hypothetical world, if Texas goes to a 9-game season plus 1, are you keeping UTEP or are you keeping USF? Dustin, I'll ask you. I'll start with that. If you go 9 games plus 1, are you keeping UTEP or are you keeping USF?
I'm probably keeping UTEP, because I think if you consider a 1-game situation before your conference slate, to me, I'd want the one with the lowest amount of travel for the opposing team and also the one that's the most likely to be a win. Because, you know, you're going to be judged on wins and losses this year, no matter what kind of pandemic's going on. So if I would want the easier game as kind of that exhibition type opportunity before you get to the conference slate, because the conference schedule can get really real, and it would for Texas. I mean, you know, you look at it like at, you know, I think at Kansas State and then Oklahoma would come up really quickly as well. So that would probably be the route that I go. But yeah, unfortunately for Texas, I know, you know, South Florida is kind of a hot spot. I believe El Paso area might be too. So I think Texas would definitely want those programs, if they played them, to make sure the testing was in order before they arrived in Austin.
Alex, same question to you.
Well, I'm with the is El Paso a hot spot now? I know so many of those border counties.
I thought it was at one point, but I honestly don't know now. I haven't looked at El Paso recently. Well,
but for me, it's easily UTEP. Like Dustin said, no interstate travel, easy game. Like this, I mean, you don't got to make it hard. Like 7 new coaches on this staff, new offensive coordinator, new defensive coordinator. Get in an exhibition game. Play UTEP. It's a game that you can't lose, because if you're Tom Herman, if you do lose, like, well, I guess they probably couldn't fire him at this point, because the big money donors all working oil, and they're not in a spot where they want to.
No one's getting fired. That's a contract. That's right. Sure.
But you can't lose to UTEP, right? And so just the level of competition is just so much different, and it'd be a good way just to kind of get the juices flowing again, get everything, you know, lubed up for the part of the season that really matters. And, you know, USF, I'm not going to act like I know a whole lot about that program, but I do know that that's a pretty fertile recruiting ground down there, and there have been players that have slipped through the cracks and have ended up at schools like USF and UCF, and they've gone on to be great players in the NFL. I'm not saying that it can't happen at UTEP. We've seen it with Will Hernandez. We've seen it with shit. We've seen it with Aaron Jones. But it's just that's why they play the games. You can't say it's an automatic win, but it feels like virtually like an automatic win. And it's a game where, seeing it as that is the case, a time where you can really take it as, you know, a good learning experiment and a good chance to get comfortable with, you know, all these new pieces, everything's new this year. I think it'd be a good sort of easy start to the season. And so that's, I would pick that. Plus, you know, like we mentioned, just the travel and stuff like that.
I'm going to go with UTEP for the same reason that you guys mentioned, and I'll just add this in. USF was scheduled to make $1.9 million. I imagine they're not playing UTEP as much money, but if you're the University of Texas and Chris Del Conte and you're looking to save some sort of money at this point, if you don't have to pay out $2 million, you know, potentially. Now, granted, there's going to be some issues here, because if you're canceling games and there's no, you know, crazy reason, like there's not a clause in there that says like, hey, you can just cancel us to cancel us. Now, there's going to have to be some settlements that are going to be reached with some of these non-conference schools. But if you have the ability and say, look, if you can save some money and you're going to probably be at 25,000, right? So that in itself means like you're going from 50 to 25. So, you know, money is it's all relative, because Texas, they make a lot of money, but they still spend a lot of money. They're still going to have less revenue, so which means that there's still going to be a trickle-down effect. Any way that the program can save some money, now couple that in with, look, USF is being coached by Jeff Scott. Jeff Scott is a disciple, former OC at Clemson, viewed as a young up-and-coming coach who, you know, bright future ahead of him. And I'm a USF grad, so I know a little bit more about USF than the average person in Texas does. USF is probably good enough to give Texas a little bit of a competition for maybe about a quarter and a half. Could possibly extend it into halftime, but I'm not quite. I don't think they're there yet. But at least a quarter and a half. UTEP from start to finish, that should be a Texas-dominated game. Like, that's just from start to finish. Now, I thought that about Rice a couple of years ago, and that necessarily didn't happen. But from start to finish, it should be all Texas. So with that being said, you take the home game, you get some revenue, you play the exhibition game. And to Alex's point, when you have seven new coaches who have not coached their team, especially to this day at full speed, it behooves you to say, make this your exhibition game, make this your learning game, make this your teachable game before you open up the season at Kansas State and then have to go into, was it Oklahoma the following week? So knowing that you might as well get the UTEP out of the way, go to Kansas State, and then face Oklahoma, which we shall see if that game is played in Dallas or that ends up being a home at home for a little bit of time. All right, let's switch the gears to basketball before we get into parting shots. And Alex, I'm going to go to you first for parting shots. So you can start thinking right now. So by the
I thought you were going to say you'd go to me first on basketball. I was asking
No. DFS basketball is back, Alex.
That's true.
I'm going to go to Dustin for basketball. You're going to go to you for parting shots. So you're going to have another 5 or so minutes to think about. Dustin, I love to talk basketball with you. Kind of out of the blue, you kind of minded your business earlier this week, and all of a sudden, Shaka gets a commit. Omarion Ellis, a guard. I got a chance to watch his film, and don't do you had some really good observations because I was watching his film, and there was this side of me. I'm like, all right, well, this is all cool, but this is all high school clips. Where's his AAU clips? Then, of course, I read the article. It's like, oh, I forgot there's no AAU this summer.
Yeah.
You know, so that's like, oh, my bad, cynical Anwar. Why don't you just shut up right now? But you had a chance to talk to the young man. You've clearly covered this program. Give us your 411. Give us your take on Omarion.
Yeah, so, you know, this recruiting cycle is so unique because there's there's been no evaluation periods, which is when the college coaches really come up with their lists and prioritize their guys and make their moves and so on and so forth. So it's forced coaches to really do a lot of background digging, a lot of, you know, film evaluation and so on and so forth. And this is another instance where Texas really trusts evaluations, and it made a move early on Omarion Ellis. And it was the first high major program to offer him. And I believe it offered him on July 24th. So he quickly moved on that offer. It announced a commitment, which is pretty rare in basketball and even in football as well. Normally there's kind of a give or take, like, hey, we're interested in you. Here's an offer. The kid's usually like, okay, I'm interested in you, but I'm also interested in all these other schools and so on and so forth. And would a program take a commitment immediately and blah, blah, blah. Texas clearly really, really likes the kid. And the more I dug, Texas has been doing some background work on him for a while. So the offer just didn't kind of come out of nowhere. They'd been communicating with him, kind of establishing a relationship, because I think they knew, hey, if we jump into the mix here with an offer, there's a good chance that he's going to jump on it. And, you know, perfect timing for Orange Bloods and Rivals people, because Eric Bossy, one of our national analysts, actually saw Omarion Ellis play last weekend in one of the few events that's actually going on with basketball, and came away really impressed. I was actually texting with him before the kid committed, and he thought that he's like a no-doubt Rivals 150 guy, a four-star caliber player, maybe even a top 100 guy in the next rankings, which is a big jump from where he is right now. And he's a two-sport guy. He's a standout football player as well, which I think has kind of played into him being a little bit under the radar. But he's one of those guys that under normal circumstances with an AAU season, his stock would have really taken off. There's no doubt in my mind about that, because he's a 6'4". He lists himself as 6'4". Some people list him as 6'5". He's a guard. I'd say he's probably more of a combo guard or a two guard right now. I think that from some people I've talked to, Texas thinks that long-term he could develop into a point guard at the college level. And I like the comparison that Eric Bossy made, in kind of a DeJounte Murray kind of skill set. Not quite that talent. I mean, DeJounte Murray was, you know, one and done at Washington and ended up being a first-round pick. It's had a pretty successful NBA career. But that kind of similar type of skill set where there's some of that length there, there's some of that explosiveness, that playmaking, that opportunity to be an impact defender. And I think down the road, he's going to shoot the ball from the perimeter in a way that you're going to have to respect it. It kind of reminds me of Courtney Ramey. Early in Courtney Ramey's senior year, he wasn't really known as a perimeter shooter. It was clearly the area that he needed to work on. He worked on it with the help of breaking his wrist, which kind of actually helped him shoot the ball better. He worked on it and became a much better three-point shooter as a high school senior. Now at Texas, it's not the main part of his game, but it's something you definitely have to respect. You have to defend him out there and account for that ability to knock that three-point shot, which I think is similar to Ellis too. But he's a kid that comes from a really unique background. I think Texas fans are going to really root for this kid once he shares his story and people kind of learn more about him. But it's funny, you know, I kind of, when I put on his tape for the first time, I thought of Isaiah Taylor, who was a former point guard at Texas, because I remember watching Isaiah Taylor for the first time, like, why aren't more programs recruiting this guy? He's clearly really good. He's a high major player. And, you know, Isaiah Taylor went on to start at Texas for 3 years at point guard and then went on to it kind of bounced in and out of the NBA, which for a guy that was really lowly rated, is an impressive feat for him. So I think this is another example of Texas. And, you know, you can say one thing about its development recently, but its evaluation skills with some of these guys. You think of Jackson Hayes when he was a three-star prospect. Jericho Sims didn't really have much recruiting attention. Donovan Williams before he blew up. Andrew Jones went from a three-star to a five-star McDonald's All-American. Jace Febres was really under the radar a bit as well. They've had pretty good success with their evaluations when they get in early with guys. And I think this is, you know, this is a coaching staff that really trusts what they do from an evaluation standpoint, and they know what they want in a guard. And he's the latest one to join the mix.
Yeah, I was gonna, you know, you took the thought process out of my head, because when it comes to the basketball team, Dustin, like no one really questions Shaka as a recruiter. Like, I think we all understand that from a recruiting standpoint. I mean, the guy's putting in people in the NBA back to back to back, right? I mean, you know, he's done this 3 straight years. No, we all totally understand. We all saw what he was able to do with pulling off Greg Brown. We, as a recruiter and as a evaluator of talent, there's no questions. Now, some people may question the coaching thing and what happens there, but I don't think there's any question that when it comes to evaluation and looking at talent, like, you know, Shaka Smart is one of the better guys in the country as far as a talent evaluation standpoint.
Yeah, no, they've had a really good track record with that. It didn't start out great his first year, but with his kind of, I guess if you want to label it, kind of like a transition class, because they kind of jumped into the mix and had to really catch up with some of the guys. And of course, missing on Carson Edwards, as many programs did, was a bit of an issue, obviously. But I think generally speaking, when you stack him up to, you know, some of the other head coaches across the country that, you know, kind of excluding the Dukes and in the you know, those types of programs who basically get to pick what they want and from a five-star basis, the evaluations and the recruiting element hasn't been the issue. It's been the on-court performance and, you know, managing the program and you know, personnel and development and so on and so forth. So this is another guy I think that, you know, over time it's going to be like, okay, this is another guy that Texas got in on really early. They beat a lot of teams to the punch, and he ended up being a really good prospect and potentially a really good player at the collegiate level. We'll see what happens with this upcoming season and this roster. But yeah, I don't think many people would debate the recruiting element in acquiring talent. It's just what's happened after that. That's been the issue at Texas.
Last question on him, and I know this is kind of tough, but when I watched his film, well, first of all, he's got football film, which is also impressive. But when I, you know, Allison knew that breakdown, but when I watched him, the couple of things that stood out, I thought he had real good handles. You know, I thought he was very quick off the ball. I liked his first step. You know, there was a lot of things about him that I liked.
you know, didn't see a ton of shooting, but you know, with the ones they shot, they all went in. But don't they always go in highlights, right? You never see bad, like, huddle highlights. You never see.
Yeah, it's amazing how 30% shooters, like, you put on the tape, and it's like, oh, man, he's got 100% from three-point range.
Yeah, it's like, you know, there's no bad highlights. You can watch anybody's highlights, and it's amazing. So, you know, and I know he's young, and comparisons are kind of hard, and but for those who haven't watched him and you would just try to compare his game to somebody, whether you feel like it's on a collegiate level, again, NBA is tricky because then people start saying, well, you said he's going to be the next Kyrie Irving. And, you know, so maybe I won't ask you that. Maybe I should just give me some more of his attributes. And if you feel like there's anything comparable to a player that kind of stands out, give me that one, because I don't want this to come back and bite you in the ass at some point.
He actually, now that you asked me that, he kind of reminds me a little bit of a guy that played at Kansas State this last season, Cartier Diarra, who was kind of their main, I guess, he's not a true point guard, but he did play some point guard for them on occasion. Actually, not on occasion, pretty often. He also bounced between the two and the three as well, kind of like that positionless mold of a guard. But he did handle a significant amount of the point guard duties for them. And he's one of those guys that he took a lot of threes and you had to respect it. He didn't shoot it at a great clip, but he shot it well enough to where you had to defend him out there. But 6'4", 185, some length, really explosive, driving to the basket, getting into the paint, kind of making some things happen there. Shot a ton of free throws, which I think speaks to his ability to kind of draw fouls by getting to the lane and things like that. He's a guy that I know when Texas played Kansas State, they really had to account for what he could do offensively in kind of a one-on-one type situation. And I think that's similar to what Ellis will bring to college. You mentioned the handles, and that's one thing that really stood out to me as well. And kind of the quickness and the ability to beat guys off the bounce and use that length when he gets into the lane and finish around the rim. So, yeah, he kind of reminds me some of Cartier Diarra, who was a junior last year at Kansas State. Similar size, similar length, kind of a similar skill set to where he's more known for the ability to beat guys off the bounce. He's got some potential as a lockdown type defender, and he shoots it well enough from beyond the arc that you've got to kind of account for, but it's not the main part of his game.
That's the last question, and we'll go to Alex to start off our parting shots. They've been working out, right? The basketball team has been doing their – are they at voluntary workouts at this moment?
So they're not voluntary, but they're like – I guess nobody wants to use the word mandatory because it's just such a unique time right now. But they are doing what are coach-led workouts. And the interesting thing about that is it's basically like the NCAA basically said, okay, on this date, you can do your coach-led activities for so many hours a week, and you can also do your strength and conditioning stuff as well. But they left it up to the individual universities, as the NCAA has done with pretty much everything during the pandemic, to come up with their whatever they're comfortable with. So while you can see, like, I know there are a lot of pictures coming out during first workouts of other programs, like Oklahoma State had, like, you know, half its team on one end of the court, half its team on the other end of the court. Texas Tech had like its whole team out there. Oklahoma had a bunch of guys. Texas right now is, and last I checked, is limited to one coach, one player, one ball at a time. So it's basically like individual skill instruction type thing led by a coach right now, because I guess Texas is not yet comfortable with throwing everybody in the gym at one time. That's obviously subject to change. And we'll probably change down the road as they get a little bit more into this. But, yeah, they are doing what they're, I guess it's called coach-led activities for the first time. They have a certain amount of hours each week that coaches can use working out with their guys.
All right, so do you got any, you know, updates on anybody? Or are you still working on that because it's just so fresh and so new? And are you still working on gathering that information?
Yeah, it's weird because they haven't, like, done any – like group stuff. So It's not like there's been some 5-on-5 or 3-on-3, but I will say from the digging around I've done, I was told that everybody, like all 13 scholarship guys, were in good standing with the program. And I think everybody's done a pretty good job off the court of handling their business, getting into the gym, working on their bodies, so on and so forth. So it's not really a situation where you're going to see a bunch of guys show up and they've clearly not picked up a basketball or not taking care of themselves from a conditioning or a weight room standpoint. I think Texas is pleased with what those guys were able to do when they weren't able to be around a coach in the gym. But, yeah, I'll be anxious to hear what things kind of look like once they're able to start doing a little bit more three-on-three and five-on-five and that type of thing. But I do think, you know, just from a couple of pictures I've seen of guys getting back to the gym and things like that, it does look like some guys have added some muscle in the offseason. Courtney Ramey, Brock Cunningham is another guy that looks like physically different. I know Kai Jones has spent a lot of time in the weight room and in the gym as well. And then of course, you know, anytime Greg Brown steps into the gym, that's a dude that's going to put on a show. So it doesn't sound like things were negative when these guys first started returning back to campus. It seems like everybody's in good shape. And I still kind of am a little bit surprised. You know, it's a very unique time, but they've got 13 scholarship guys that are all capable of playing, all guys that have played, you know, during certain points in times, and many guys that have started. At some point, you got to wonder, like, are all 13 guys going to stay at Texas? You know, when so many guys are often seeking playing time and things like that. So I think that's still something that's going to be worth following moving forward, especially when these guys get into five-on-five type situations. I would be a little bit surprised if they get into five-on-five play and some of the dudes competing for minutes with Greg Brown see him and you know, think that they're going to play over Greg Brown, because that's just not going to happen. He's going to start, and he's going to play a lot for Texas.
He's going to play a lot, and definitely we'll have to enjoy him for the 1 year that yes. he will be here.
Let's hope we get a full season to watch him, well, because that'd yes. be a real bummer if we don't.
Yeah, definitely. So it'll definitely be good. At least the drive in for him is pretty good. No, he's on campus, right? Is Greg and all the basketball team, they're all living on campus right now. Is
yeah, so it's – yeah, with those young guys like Greg, it's a dorm type thing. But so many of those guys are – basically upperclassmen. It's strange. Shaka Smart's got a ton of upperclassmen on a team for a change. Many of those guys live off campus, but yeah, in terms of being in Austin and things like that, they went through the onboarding process without any issue, which was good to hear.
All right. Well, listen, who needs Ketch? Who needs Jason? Like the three amigos, like we were able to carry this podcast, and hope you guys enjoyed it. And so let's do our part in shots. Alex, you've had just plenty of time to think of a parting shot. There's
you
no
you
way.
Said five, you said 5 minutes.
And it
man.
Gave you like 15. I was listening
to basketball for 20 minutes.
Which I figured you would tune out. So you would just be listening for your name. It's like when you're talking to someone who speaks a different language, you just listen for your name. Like you're talking about me. I heard my name. I figured you would zone back in when we said the word Alex. And so Alex, come out of your trance and give us your parting shot.
I'm just trying to think, you know, just with sports coming back, I'm trying to think, you know, we have basketball tonight. I'm not that interested in basketball with, you know, just for one, I'm not a fan of it. For two, I just think the NBA has been so cockamamie with the way their conspicuous silence about, you know, taking all this money from China and then not acknowledging, you know, the genocide and the horrible human rights violations going on over there. So not too excited about the restart of the NBA, but I will be gambling on it tonight. what? I am, however, excited about the baseball season. As Dustin knows, I've been texting him before every slate, just talking about you know, different plays and you know, getting to watch these teams. I've been excited about it. I know that there was the dust up early this week, wherever, you know, the media just could not quit talking about the Miami Marlins. It's still a big story. How the season's going to end? This is why you can't play baseball in a without a bubble, blah, blah, et cetera, et cetera. Like, why have I not heard any reporting about how the Phillies aren't testing positive? It's like, how have I not heard anything about, like, I'm trying to look for news stories about this, and it's like there's not any shocking off, you know, headlines about no Phillies players after the last two tests. Now, I don't want to whistle past the graveyard here. The virus could take a while to show up, but if it doesn't show up in these Phillies players, I think that it's going to give us, like, talk about waiting for clues and waiting to see how things work and waiting for the most information that you can. It would seem like if these Phillies players keep showing up negative after knowing, you know, now that we know that these Miami Marlins, they went up to Philadelphia. What that'll teach us is, one, it seems like maybe transmission of this thing outdoors, playing a sport like baseball, even where they're kind of, they're not wearing masks out there for the most part. When they're in the dugout, they're wearing masks, but they're not necessarily socially distanced. It makes me think the transmission outdoors might really not be too much of a thing that these guys need to worry about, which obviously bodes extremely well for football. Now, for football, there's definitely a, you know, more of a lack of social distancing, a lot more contact, stuff like that. But the thing that it seems like in baseball, if it can run rampant through a clubhouse like it has with the Miami Marlins, is, well, we're hearing more and more stories. And Dustin, is Bob Nightingale a worthy source, or is he a bad source?
He's a worthy reporter. His opinions are often idiotic, but okay. From a reporting element, he's a guy that's been doing this for a really, really long time. But yeah, I was going to mention that, you know, he reported about, you know, he heard that they believe this started because Marlins players went out in Atlanta and then basically came back and spread it around everywhere. So yeah, the Phillies thing would be hugely important that they don't have any positives, because those two teams played each other and would suggest that, okay, from a playing standpoint, this can work.
Yeah. And so like I said, not trying to whistle past the graveyard here, you know, that this thing could take a while to show up, but I'm just like, I'm not seeing that many reports saying, hey guys, look, you know, so far so good with the Phillies. Maybe it's, you know, heck, maybe it's good. Maybe it's good news that this thing, you know, has a better chance. I think where teams are going to need to address what they're doing is in these clubhouses, in these locker rooms, in these confined spaces where these players can get together. And they're also going to need to get their act together. Like they need to realize that in a season like this, half the battle is not, you know, it's going to be won off the field. It's like, it's wild, but half this battle is going to be won off the area where the game's actually played, with their players actually saying, you know what, I care about the team. I care about staying healthy. I care about making sure that I don't pass this thing on to anybody else to give us the best chance. I think it's an interesting dynamic to add into a baseball season. I think that the only other thing that I worry about, where football has a distinct advantage here, is just the massive travel. You know, like, you travel around, you add in more variables for possible exposure, for possibly putting yourself at a little bit greater risk. I mean, in football, there's only 15 games. You really only travel for, you know, either seven or eight, or, I mean, six. I'm sorry, six. I'm such a fantasy guy that I'm just thinking about the 15 games for the fantasy regular season. But it's just 16 games. You know, you're going to travel for eight of them. You're going to be home for eight of, you know, you travel eight times. So I saw yesterday what the Detroit Lions have done with their locker room. Anwar, I know that's a place where you've spent a whole lot of time. You would not even recognize that damn thing with how they've socially distanced it with all the plexiglass and stuff like that. You've seen what the Atlanta Falcons are doing, where they're in the Mercedes-Benz Stadium. They're just, instead of giving these guys lockers, you know how they have suites there where you can go stay, and it's like stay the night if you're, you know, a fan that just wants to stay there at the stadium? They're just turning those into the locker rooms. So each guy's got his own bathroom, his own shower, stuff like that. Now, will every team be able to do that? No, but these teams are coming on the NFL side are coming up with great ways to deal with it. I just, you know, well, I'm going to say it a third time. I'm not trying to whistle past the graveyard about the Phillies thing, but the Miami Marlins, from what I can tell, might have even known that up to four of these guys at least were presumptive positives, and they still decided to go out and play. How the decision was left up to them, I have no goddamn idea. I know it would not happen in the NFL because of the infectious disease emergency response plans that have now been approved from Dr. Sills to the NFLPA by the NFLPA for all 32 teams. That is not an effective emergency response to an infectious disease to leave up to players and staff on the team about whether you'll be taking the field against a team unbeknownst to them that you are have four players presumptive positive. So even whenever that sort of egregious behavior does exist, we're still getting negative tests out of the guys who were just on the field with these guys for the amount of time during the play over the course of a weekend series of games. So good news to me that we're on Thursday and we've had now two tests. The back of daily testing, as always, something to monitor and something to keep an eye on. But I think it bodes well. You know, I'm hoping for the best. I'm knocking on wood, and I'm just not hearing a whole lot about it.
Alex, I am looking at the Detroit Lions locker room, and yeah, the plexiglass stuff is interesting. Of course, reporters aren't going to be in anybody's locker room this year and anytime soon. I think every reporter, I was talking to some NFL guys this week, and the most of them are prepared to do all their interviews through Zoom. And that could potentially include post game. That's a potential. Dustin, how are they doing it in baseball? Do you know how they're doing it?
From what I've seen, it's all Zoom. And it's, you know, somebody brought up the point earlier this week, you know, Clayton Kershaw was a late scratch from his opening day start. And it was a surprise to a lot of people. And people are like, well, there was no reporters in the clubhouse. Like, normally you'd see reporters would be around and see, okay, he's not really throwing on this normal day. Maybe he's icing. Maybe he's in the training room. They would have asked questions like, hey, man, what's up? Are you feeling okay? You know? And because there weren't anybody around, it was like a surprise. Like, Clayton Kershaw is not going to start on opening day. So from everything I've seen, they've done everything over Zoom, and they just kind of have managers and players after the game doing Zoom interviews.
I mean, that's probably something that we're going to have to get used to going forward. You know, we'll figure out what they're going to do as college football and UT is concerned. But are reporters still traveling, Dustin? Before you get to your part of the shot, are reporters traveling to other cities and then doing interviews through Zoom after the games?
Yeah, I think some are. I mean, a couple of the Pirates writers that I follow were in St. Louis when the Pirates were there. So yeah,
can they go on the field though? They can go on the field prior to the games, correct?
I think so. Okay. I think there's some access that they have, but in terms of like the actual interview process, I know that after the games, everything I've seen, cause I've seen some people capturing clips on Zoom and sharing them online. So I think that's how they're doing it.
It'd be fascinating because usually, for those who don't know, in baseball, reporters are allowed, in the dugout, and of course in the locker rooms, so around batting practice, they can all like hang out with the dugout. There's usually a time frame in there where the manager will come out and they'll do some interviews prior to that. Maybe go into the locker room and interview guys beforehand. Go up, maybe about an hour-ish or so before the game, you know, type up their stuff, and then, you know, go back down afterwards. And I think all of us have got to get used to that's not going to happen anytime soon. The same way, Alex, I know as much as you want to go to a Texas Longhorn football practice, I just don't anticipate that happening. But we'll save that rant for another day. You missed out on your opportunity. Dustin, give us your parting shot.
So I dedicate this one to my wife. Today is actually her birthday. So happy birthday to her.
Congratulations. Don't tell us her age. But
I'm not doing that. But it's, you know, as you guys have experienced, it's just like they kind of get like supermom powers, you know, whenever a child arrives. And I'm just constantly just amazed at like constantly having a smile on her face and all this energy, even though like getting up really early with them and doing a full-time job and just taking care of him and just organizing everything from like, you know, when he goes to the doctor and what is he eating and checking in on his progress. And okay, this at this point in time, he should be doing this and so on and so forth. So, you know, happy birthday to my lovely wife. I'm just constantly each day amazed at like her ability to just put on a happy face, find all this energy, and just knock out her job at a high level and then help raise our little man as well and not go crazy in the process as we've kind of been stuck in the house the whole time. So happy birthday to her. We're going to try to make it the best one that we can during a global pandemic and hopefully many, many, many more successful years of us living long and healthy lives.
You know, well, happy birthday. That is really cool. What do you guys got planned for today? What are you guys going to do to celebrate?
So she's actually going to do a distance, I guess, dinner in the backyard with a couple of her girlfriends tonight. Do kind of the same thing with her family on Friday. Then actually my family's coming in from Houston on Sunday because they haven't seen Jack since early May. So they're coming in to kind of do some of the similar thing as well. So, a lot of that type of thing. You know, I gave her a mini scavenger hunt this morning to find some coupons from Dustin for certain, things and, you know, like, you know, a trip to, you know, we've been talking about trying to add some plants and some landscaping type things to the yard, a trip to go do that. She's huge into cheese, and one of the cheese places in Austin is doing a virtual cheese class you can sign up for. You go pick up the cheese and bring it back to your house and then get on online and kind of do like a cheese tasting type course. Going to do one of those things as well. It's been weird. Like we haven't eaten at a restaurant like since like the second week of March, and we're kind of like, is it okay to go on a patio? Like, I don't know if we'll end up doing that. But we'll definitely try to get out of the house and do something different, in some way, but definitely, you know, fortunately she's got a lot of family in Austin, which have really helped with this process. And then my family, at least the ones that live in Texas, aren't that far. So that'll help make the birthday a normal one for the circumstances.
Dustin, you should give her IOU and get on Cameo and tell her and get one of her favorite celebrities or actresses.
Oh, yeah, that's a good idea.
Give her a birthday shout out. Tell her I got one coming for you in a little bit.
All right, awesome. Yeah, I forgot about that. She got one when Jack was born from one of her America's Next Top Model
favorite
people.
Nice.
So yeah, that was, I totally forgot about the cameo. That's a great idea.
Yeah, it's okay. Alex, you know what I'm talking about?
I was doing that whole zone out thing again, man.
You better be making some lineups, Alex. I better see some lineups from you in a little bit.
I was told him about Cameo. You know that website?
Yeah.
I was telling you, he was only talking about his wife and celebrating his birthday when you zoned out. But I gave a potential idea for Liz. So happy birthday, Liz. Alex, do not zone out on this, because I'm going to mention you and a few other people here. So stay tuned. For my parting shot, it's really something like this. You know, as we're getting closer to football, and you know, we are another month and a half away from football, but we're anticipating it's going to start in September. My parting shot is this: I want to give the Orange Bloods crew a shout out for the work that everybody has done for months. It is very, very hard to come up with content without a practice, without a game, to have been to write for. Here we are in, you know, 8 straight months, and we haven't had a football practice since the bowl game in December. That's the last time we've had a football practice. But yet, since that time frame, you can say, well, you guys get paid to do this, but we've never had to experience anything like this. And I look at what Alex has been able to do in order to be, when he's been able to put out depth charts every single week and put out analysis every single week. It is very difficult, trust me, to crunch numbers and try to look for different angles week after week, multiple times a week, and to provide that for you. But he has been able to do that. Dustin, you know, as much as Alex likes to dive into numbers, I would put Dustin high up there as a guy who loves to dive into numbers. And when you get into his columns every single week, Dustin has been a guy that he's been diving into numbers, trying to find different things, unique angles, trying to keep everyone engaged and to keep our readers and really all you guys engaged in everything. In addition to putting out 2 podcasts a week, in addition to putting out basketball stories and baseball stories, and again, a guy who hasn't had a basketball practice, who's talking to you basically about one coach working with a player, a guy's working on air essentially, and Dustin's been able to do that. I look at what Jason has been able to do from a recruiting standpoint. Now, he hasn't delivered a whole lot lately, but he still has been on top of it, and he's a guy that even while on vacation has been checking in and trying to write stories, and he's been checking in with us behind the scenes. You're thinking like, man, go ahead and enjoy your vacation, but he showed a lot of dedication to the craft. And as much shit as we give Catch, you know, he has been here. He's been consistent. And, you know, the one thing that he does better than all of us is he's very good about board interaction. Catch doesn't get Catch does not pay attention to any of the notifications, because he is always on the board, always consistent, always in the thread, always interacting with everyone. I've been trying to give you as much news as possible over the past few months, but it's not about me patting myself on the back, because I'm really trying to pump up my brethren. So my parting shot is props to the Orange Bloods crew.
I'll pat you on the back, because you've been killing it, man. You really have. From a reporting element and keeping everybody up to date with the football team and everything, nobody's doing it better than you are right now.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that. And this is unprecedented time. So I want to say to this Orange Blood staff has been kick-ass, man. I mean, really kick-ass in unprecedented times where, listen, we know if we don't give you and deliver the hits, you can go elsewhere. You can say, I can save my money. But the fact that you guys aren't, it shows that we are trying our best and hardest to provide you guys with content. So my parting shot is props and kudos to the Orange OB staff because you guys have been kicking ass and taking names, and we all have been trying to do the same. And let's just keep it up and hope that we have football in the near future, and hopefully sometime in September. So for Jeff Ketchum, who may or may not be around next week because who knows what's going on with that Zoom conference. I'm assuming it's crashed at least three times so far. Sukumel should probably be back next week. But for Alex and for Dustin, want to say thank you. Hey, Ticket City. At some point, they're going to be selling tickets. Like, we're getting close. It may not be a ton, but those tickets are going to be at a premium for football games this year. That means if you want to go, Ticket City might be your main hookup. So just wait in a few weeks. Just make a freaking announcement, Big 12, and let's go ahead and get this thing started. And then Ticket City will be your hookup, guys. And it got basketball coming up. Well, can't really do tickets for basketball, but at least for football. So for Alex and Dustin and the entire crew, thank you guys for listening. Ketch will be back. We appreciate everything. We'll talk to you guys soon. All right, fellas.
Good podcast.
All right, boys. All right, guys.
Nice. Thanks for the nice words. Appreciate it.
No problem. Yeah, get up and happy birthday to Liz.
Will do. I'll pass it along.
All right, guys. Take care.
See you.